Well, it's time to take a look at the world of insects in Wisconsin. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is PJ Leash. He's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll talk about pollinators and give us an update on Wisconsin's spongy moth population. And, of course, take your questions as well as we move along. Tell us about the insects crawling around your yard or maybe in your house this spring. I've got a couple of ants I've noticed here and there scrambling around the house. Oh, man. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. PJ Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
It's great to be here today, Larry.
So what about those ants that are, you know, I think I've seen three or four this spring at various times. I don't think there's a nest in the house.
Yeah, and that very well could be the case. We are simply at a time of the year where there is a lot of ant activity. And I mean, in general, insect activity is really starting to pick up with some of these warmer temperatures we've had in the last week. So at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, I have seen an uptick in ant cases just in the last 2 weeks or so. And there's a lot of things that could be going on. Occasionally, there can be ant nests indoors, although if that were the case, you probably would have been seeing ants through the winter months, perhaps. So if you've just seen ants recently, a very plausible explanation for that is it's a nest outdoors, and they can sneak in through some pretty tiny gaps. Some of the top ants I've been seeing recently are species like the odorous house ant, the pavement ant, and starting to see a lot of carpenter ant activity, which is pretty typical for the time of the year.
Well, what about spongy moths? This is something that we've been concerned about. I understand this year is going to be a big year for the invasive spongy moth. Tell us about the moth again. How do we identify it, and what kind of conditions are needed for the spongy moth population to surge?
Sure. So first and foremost, if you're a listener and you haven't heard necessarily of spongy moth before and you're wondering what that is, you've almost certainly heard of this insect by its prior name. This insect used to be known as the gypsy moth, but the common approved name for the insect has been changed in the last year or so to spongy moth. This is a non-native invasive insect. It's originally from parts of Europe, has been in the country since about the 1860s in New England area. It spread very, very slowly, and it's been here in Wisconsin for many decades at this point. But these are caterpillars that can cause a lot of defoliation, especially to certain types of trees, both in urban forests, yard trees, things like that, but also out in wooded and forested areas. And every once in a while, we will have some pretty notable outbreaks of these insects. Last year, we had some very significant defoliation that the DNR reported. I think the number of acres defoliated was somewhere around 85,000 or so. Whereas if you go back 3-4 years ago, we were seeing almost no or very little defoliation in date. So what is going on with these spongy moths and why we might be having a big year has to do with some of the weather patterns. If you look at the big picture here, Larry, there is an introduced fungus called Entomophaga myrmica, and this is a disease which is really specific to the spongy moth caterpillars. And if we have years where we get a kind of average, above average amount of rainfall in April and May, that can really encourage this fungus, and it can help keep spongy moth populations in check. But if you look at the weather patterns we've had the last 2 years, many parts of the state, it has been really quite dry, including some pretty severe droughts in some parts of Wisconsin. And with the drier conditions the last two springs, it has suppressed this fungus, allowing spongy moth populations to greatly increase. And we can actually look at some things and kind of predict what we may see in a future year. And what I'm getting at would be egg masses. And those egg masses are laid sometime in July or August in most areas in the state. And they don't hatch until the following spring, right around this time of the year. So they're sitting there for maybe 8 or so months. And you can basically count the number of egg masses and kind of guesstimate how many caterpillars you might see in your own area. And based on surveys done in the state, we know there's an awful lot of egg masses out there in some areas. So that's why we're expecting to have a big year for spongy moth. But as I mentioned, that fungal disease, that's kind of the trump card that could be at play. If we have rainy conditions for this spring going forward, that could really help us out and turn the tide. But if things turn drier again, then those caterpillars are probably going to have a really good year and could cause an awful lot of defoliation in the state.
The egg masses themselves, I think they're fairly easy to identify. And what should people, say you're in a city or a town and you look at your tree that you've got on your lawn or your trees, and maybe there's some small ones, you can see the egg masses. What's the trick to getting rid of them?
A couple of things you could do. At this point in the game, we have warmed up enough that in at least southern Wisconsin, those egg masses have started hatching. And so we really kind of missed the boat in terms of being able to do something about the egg masses. If we were having this conversation maybe a month or two ago and the egg masses hadn't hatched yet, there's some things you can do. You can physically scrape them off and remove them with like a putty knife or something else along those lines. But there's a caveat. If you simply scrape the eggs off and let them tumble onto the ground and you leave them there, they're still almost certainly going to hatch. So you would really need to scrape them off into like a container of soapy water or a bag and send them to the landfill or something like that to actually take them out of the equation. But that is an option. And I really encourage folks to do that because, as I mentioned a minute ago, those eggs are sitting there for maybe a window of 8 months or so. That's a long period of time where you can check the trees in your yard, look for those egg masses. Also, looking at the egg masses can help you prepare. If you look at them now, you're seeing a lot of tiny holes, you're seeing small caterpillars to tell you that they've hatched. There's some other things that we can do. You can do an approach called a sticky barrier band. You basically wrap the tree trunk with saran wrap, and then you can put a sticky coating on that. Could be Vaseline. If you're into gardening, you've maybe heard of Tanglefoot, which is this really, really sticky stuff. That way, when the small caterpillars are trying to climb up the tree, because a lot of them fall out of trees to begin with, or they get blown in the wind, process called ballooning. But if they try and crawl up the tree trunks and they touch the sticky stuff, they get caught and they get stuck and they die. So that's another approach. If the eggs haven't hatched yet, there are some treatments you can do with dormant oils. Some of the better ones are really hard to find, though, from my experience. But there's a number of ways that you can go about dealing with the eggs or especially small caterpillars once they become active.
Let's take some calls. Tom and DePere has a question. Let's go there. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling. We have stink bugs that are a recent arrival in our house. Myself and my neighbors, immediate adjacent neighbors, have the same issue. I talked to somebody who's three blocks away. They don't know what I'm talking about. Could you give me a little history or something about the stink bugs and what I can do to get rid of them?
Sure. So when you're talking about stink bugs indoors, it's almost certainly an invasive species called the brown marmorated stink bug. And this is an insect species that we've maybe had in Wisconsin for a little over a decade. I think our first report was somewhere back around 2010 or so. But they're not everywhere yet. It's a newer species. It's still expanding into some areas. So there are some hot spots of activity in southern Wisconsin, south central, like Madison, down to Janesville area, the greater Milwaukee, Waukesha area, lots of activity there. And then a third hot spot in my mind is the kind of the Fox River corridor from like Oshkosh on up to Green Bay area. So it's really not too surprising to hear about activity of these insects and that you're spotting them in your house. The general story with these is during the warmer months, so spring and especially the summer months, these are plant feeding insects and they can feed on a very wide range of plants. They really like fruiting structures. So a lot of garden vegetables, fruits like cherries, apples, peaches, plums can be fed on. But they have habits very similar to some of our kind of structural invader type insects, box elder bugs, multicolored Asian lady beetles. These are insects that like to seek out sheltered overwintering spots in the fall. And so we get into September, October, we start getting some cooler evenings, and that can signal these insects, to these insects that winter is coming, and then they start trying to sneak in through nooks and crannies. So if someone has issues with these in their homes, I really don't suggest spraying indoors, especially if you're seeing them this time of the year. They have overwintered, they're running on fumes, they don't have a whole lot of energy stored up. But I really emphasize more trying to prevent them from getting into your home in the fall. That will give you a lot more bang for your buck, so to speak. So one approach is what we call physical exclusion, looking at your home, trying to identify potential entry points for these insects. So that could be cracks and crevices around doors and windows, soffit areas where you have edges of siding. Anything you can do to kind of physically seal those areas up better with caulk, expanding insulation foam, backer rod, anything along those lines, even better weather stripping, that can help keep them outdoors. So that's one approach. And that may be some upfront effort and cost, but that can be effective in the long run. You could also, if you have lots of these, treat the exterior of your home in fall, those same areas around window, door frames. The idea is we can kill or repel them before they get in. So you're not necessarily going and spraying your whole yard. I wouldn't recommend that. But you just spray little strips around doors and window frames and soffit edges where these insects might be trying to get in. Those are the approaches that tend to help. Once they get in, as I mentioned, I really don't recommend spraying for them. Personally, I would take the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and just suck them up at this point. Or you could squish them. But I would generally recommend using a tissue or paper towel because they do have a very strong pungent odor. They are stink bugs. They've got some defensive compounds, which if you squish them with bare fingers, that scent can stay on your skin for quite a while.
Long time. A long time. Lydia in Mount Horeb, what's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I live in a rural area, and I've been here for 30 years, but this year I have been getting tick bites and have had 4 already this season. I'm wondering how much longer will the season last for ticks?
So they were attached to your body, Lydia?
They were.
They were.
Yes.
They were removed. Okay. Well, the news probably isn't very good on that front, PJ.
Yeah, unfortunately not. When it comes to ticks, I really like to tell folks, anytime it is warm enough that it's above freezing and there's no snow on the ground, you can potentially bump into ticks. And we, of course, do have more than one tick species in the state. For us in Wisconsin, it really primarily boils down to deer ticks and the American dog tick, or sometimes folks call it the wood tick. Those would be the two commonest by far. They actually have slightly different life cycles, so you tend to bump in certain tick species or tick life stages at various times of the year. At the moment, though, we're right in the midst of kind of peak tick season, especially for those deer ticks, or black-legged ticks is another name for them. So for the foreseeable future, I would strongly encourage you to be using repellents, doing daily tick checks and things like that. Often as we get into the summer months, you're not going to be bumping into those adult deer ticks as much, but we can bump into other tick species at that time. So again, this tick season in Wisconsin can be pretty prolonged. I have folks bump into ticks in February sometimes, maybe even January if it's warm enough, if we have a really warm spell. And you can easily bump into ticks into November and December sometimes. So it really is a pretty long season where you might bump into them, but right now we're in a really key period, probably for another month or so.
Sorry, Lydia, but I appreciate your call. Thanks so much for joining in. PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest today. Clara Neipertz, our producer. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking insects today with PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Chris in Black Creek has a question for us. Let's go there. Chris, hi.
Hey, guys. My goodness, ticks. When I was a kid, I had like 70 of them on me. I must have stood right into a nest. But duct tape reversed, like your guest mentioned, they'll get stuck to it. So you put it around your ankles, you put it around your waist, and you'd be surprised how many you can catch. But ants I've torn a lot of properties apart in my construction building. If they only had a couple of carpenter ants, sooner or later I'd find a nest, and it would be a waterfall of this huge nest every time I'd find them. But my
That's true. You've seen swarms like that, haven't you, PJ?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, if you bump into a carpenter ant nest itself, they can often be very substantial in size. Hundreds, if not thousands, of workers. Sometimes, depending on the time of the year, you'll bump into winged females and males. This would be the swarmers that would leave the nest. I will mention, though, if you simply see some carpenter ants around your yard or maybe even on the side of the home, it doesn't necessarily mean, though, that there is a nest in your structure, in your home or other building like a garage or shed or something like that. It turns out that carpenter ants can really travel some pretty long distances. And I've seen lots and lots of cases where the actual nest is out a ways in a yard, maybe in a firewood pile or part of a tree that has a little bit of decay and rot going on in it that you may not even be aware of. And that's the main source of the nest. But these worker ants can travel long distances. It often takes them many years to be able to build up to that size. And depending on some of the dynamics in the nest, they can actually do something where they create satellite nests or satellite outposts where they will take a bunch of workers and eggs and larvae and haul them to another location. And there doesn't necessarily have to be any decaying wood there. It might just be a protected spot in a soffit area or other spot. So they can really do some interesting things and show up in some unusual spots, Larry.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Kel in Sugar Camp. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. Every spring I see hair streak butterflies, little blue guys. And yesterday I saw one that was only very tiny, about a half inch in diameter with the wings closed. And it was very silvery with just a hint of blue on the outside and just very light blue on the inside. And of course it had little spots on the outside, a little bit of orange. But I was wondering if there's different subspecies in Wisconsin.
Yeah, great question. I mean, when it comes to the hair streak butterflies, there's a really excellent website out there for butterflies here in the state of Wisconsin. It's simply called wisconsinbutterflies.org. And last time I checked it, I think there's something like 15 or more different species in the state from that hair streak group. So it's not necessarily subspecies, but there are a lot of very similar looking species, and especially when their wings are closed up, which they tend to do at rest, and you tend to see these silvers and grays, little black streaks, maybe some blue and orange spots here and there. You really need to have them either sit still or get a good photograph of them to be able to kind of look at and decipher that pattern, because again, there's a lot of different species from that group that we can bump into here in the state.
Thank you very much for calling, Kel. Appreciate your call. Tim in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention, too, about ticks. I've had a lot of ticks on me, and I'm the critters that are vectored by them, like Lyme's disease, is something to be really cautious of. But my main question is... I just heard about a condition of linden trees where they get a fungus or something on them, and it attracts a fly that gets predated by the fungus, and they're called zombie flies. Are you familiar with that phenomenon?
I bet you are, BJ.
I am. Yeah, so I guess... just to follow up on the first comment from that caller, the ticks and diseases, that really is an emerging health threat for us here in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. When we think of insects and related creatures that transmit diseases, I mean, worldwide, we tend to think of stuff like mosquitoes. And no doubt we have some concerns here in Wisconsin. There are diseases we've heard of like West Nile virus, Eastern equine encephalitis, and so on. But when you look at the actual case numbers for those every year, it tends to be really pretty low. Whereas with ticks, we can have many, many more cases of things like Lyme disease. Then you've got anaplasmosis and babesiosis, and those are also transmitted by deer ticks, which carry Lyme as well. Depending on the other tick species out there, you can bump into some other diseases as well, some rare viruses, ehrlichiosis, and things like that. And so when you look at the sheer number of cases, I was on the CDC website looking recently for like Lyme disease cases, and I think there's somewhere in the ballpark of about 30,000 Lyme cases that are submitted to the CDC. But they believe that's really an underrepresentation. And there's a lot of people that are maybe being treated and it's not formally reported. And the number may be 10 to perhaps 15 times higher than that. So really, for the upper Midwest, we have a lot of ticks. And nationally, ticks are a big and emerging medical concern. In terms of the linden trees and these kind of zombie flies, I am familiar with those zombie flies, although it's not necessarily specific to linden trees. And I mentioned a somewhat similar topic at the beginning of the show. I mentioned that fungus called Entomophaga myemiga that can infect spongy moth caterpillars. It turns out when you look at insects, there's a whole range of pathogens. And these are very, very specific to insects. So there is a disease that can infect certain types of flies, especially in spring if we have rainy conditions. The flies get infected, and it actually affects their brain and their behavior. And so what these flies do is they tend to go up to elevated positions. I've seen them many times up on tree leaves. Before they die, they latch on, and then they just hang there. And they are at an elevated position, so the fungus can reproduce. These spores burst out of the body cavity of the insect, and because they're higher up, the wind can disperse those spores more easily. So there are really specific entomopathogens like that for flies. There are some for spiders and other types of insects as well. So it's really a fascinating topic. The way that these things work, the way that they literally change the behavior of the insects is really something almost out of science fiction. You think about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it. Christina in Glenwood, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you. For the very first time in 23 years, I have tiny little ants in my house on the counter snooping around. There's nothing there. What can I do?
Yeah. So common situation this time of year, and you're definitely not alone, Christina. Often a first recommendation in a case like this is to sit there and observe the ants for a while. It might be 10 minutes, it might be 30 minutes, but sometimes that can really give you some important clues in terms of where they're coming from and where they're going to. If you notice that they seem to be coming through a particular windowsill, you might have to go to the outside of the house, but you might see them walk down the siding and go to a nearby ant nest in the ground. If that's the case, great, you figured out where the source is and you can directly treat that nest if need be. And that could be the end of it pretty quickly. In other cases, though, you may look and watch and observe and you just can't seem to find where the nest is. If that's the case, then it might be helpful to start looking at some potential baits. Now, when it comes to ant baits, each ant species has slightly different preferences in terms of the foods that they like. Some prefer more sugary substances, and out in nature, that could be sap, that could be honeydew from aphids and things like that. Other ants maybe prefer more protein or fat-based foods. So one thing you could try, a little experiment in your house, I would maybe cut out some little pieces, squares of wax paper, and put a couple different types of food on the wax paper. You could put like a jam or jelly or honey, a sugar source. You could maybe try some peanut butter as more of a protein and fat source, maybe a little bit of tuna or some other protein source. Figure out which type of food they like to go to, because then that can help you decide which type of bait to look for at the hardware store. And often you have to sit there and read the boxes, but it'll tell you this bait is for sugar-loving ants or for protein-loving ants, that sort of thing. You could also consider collecting some of the ants and sending them into the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. That way I can look at them under the microscope, identify them for you, let you know the species, and give you some more concrete information on management. But often, in many cases, if you can figure out the type of food they like and choose an appropriate bait, that can often do the trick.
And I think that's what Jean in Sun Prairie was asking about in an email. She's been using Taro liquid ant baits but seems to be no match for the black field ants in her house the last few weeks. She has three baits out, and it may be that she has the wrong bait.
I think that's exactly the case, Larry. If you put out an ant bait, if it's a food that the ants like, you know, if it's a sugar-loving ant and you put it out and they're feeding on it 10 minutes later, that's a really good sign. But if you put those baits out and you watch and over a couple days, they just are not going to it, that tells me it is probably not the right type of food in that bait formulation that they like. And I would probably switch it out for a different type of bait. I know the very common taro liquid ant bait is essentially a sugar-based bait with borates or borax in it. And again, if you have an ant that is looking more for protein or fat, it's simply going to walk right on by and ignore it. But if you go to the hardware store, they have some baits that are basically formulated with a food item such as peanut butter. And maybe you read the box and it'll say pavement ants, that's a common protein-loving one, or for protein or fat-loving ants. If you see something like that, try that. And if that still doesn't do the trick, then I'd suggest sending in a sample so we can really pin down the exact ID, see if there's something weird going on. But often simply switching to another type of bait will do the trick.
Let's go to Bob in Superior next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking the call. Love your show, Larry. I especially like the weather guys, and that Freiburger guy's amazing. But we had a miserable spring up here. Never hit 50 degrees until Easter Sunday. The next 3 days were just glorious. Melted 30 inches of snow in 3 days. So I'm sitting on my deck, April 12th, 70 plus degrees, feeling the sun on my bare arms for the first time since October, and across the yard flies a dragonfly. How is this possible? This is 3 weeks before the ice went out anywhere. They overwinter as adults?
In general, no. However, we have certain dragonflies that are migratory, and they can show up surprisingly early in the year. So a very common one is the green darner. That's a very well-known migratory species. You know, without seeing it myself, that would kind of be my top suspect off the top of my head. And because these dragonflies, the migratory ones, can be coming up from southern U.S., they can really be influenced by some of the major storm systems and weather patterns across the continental U.S. And so if the jet stream dips down and is just right and it carries them and basically fires them all the way northward, they can show up surprisingly quickly. There's actually entire books kind of written on that topic of meteorology, where it kind of interacts with insects, because it's very well known. And if you change frequencies and other criteria on radar systems, you can actually track movements of all sorts of creatures, birds and insects and things like that. So to the general public, we may not think about this, but the jet stream is constantly, especially in spring with shifts in our weather patterns, it's bringing things up here from down south. So I think it's probably one of those migratory dragonflies that just happened to show up pretty early when you maybe still had some snow on the ground.
There you go, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jan in Middleton called regarding the person who had gotten multiple tick bites. She says we should make sure the caller got a Lyme disease test. Jan and her husband were bitten many times last year. Both of them got tested, and her husband tested positive for Lyme disease. So it's important to get tested early so it can be treated right away.
Yeah, and that's a really important point, Larry. I'm glad the individual brought that up. When you look at deer ticks here in the state, so they go through different life stages. They essentially hatch out of the egg. We get the very first stage called a larva. And the larvae of ticks do not have Lyme disease yet. They actually have to feed on a small mammal like a mouse to have a chance of picking it up. Now, when you look at the next life stage of deer ticks, that's the nymph. And this is kind of the adolescent stage. They're not reproductive adults yet. They're kind of in between that very early stage and adults. Those statewide, the average is about 20% of them are carrying Lyme. Then they feed a second time, and then they mature to the adult stage. And at the moment, our statewide average, our rate of infectivity for adult deer ticks is about 40%. So that's almost a coin flip. And this can vary geographically within Wisconsin. I have seen studies from some areas up by like Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls, where in a study site, the rate of infectivity might have been more like 60%. So a very high percentage of our ticks, our deer ticks, are carrying Lyme as adults in Wisconsin. Another important aspect of this is for transmission of Lyme, the ticks actually have to be attached for a pretty decent amount of time. It's around 36 hours or longer. And so that's why I always recommend to folks, make sure you're doing those tick checks. Because even if you had a deer tick that was Lyme positive, but it's only on you biting for a couple of hours and you remove it quickly and it's not on there for days and days, that greatly decreases your chance of transmission of Lyme. So that can be a very, very helpful precaution as well, in addition to all the repellents and wearing long sleeves and things like that, which should be standard precautions during tick season.
And just relating to that, oops, I just lost the note here. Let me get it back. Karen, I'm sorry, just a minute here. Paul from Eau Claire, here it is. Paul from Eau Claire called too and couldn't stay with us, but is wondering if chickens actually help decrease the tick population in a yard.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. That is a question that I do get from time to time, folks looking up chickens, guinea fowls, and things like that. And I just haven't seen any good papers backing that up. Undoubtedly, I mean, they may eat some. There are other animals like possums that for whatever reason seem to get hyped up as these like Hoover vacuum cleaners going around and sucking up ticks and eating them. But the science just hasn't backed up that claim either. So there are some vertebrates that indeed may eat ticks from time to time, but I just haven't seen any reports or scientific papers showing that they will go in a yard and take out tick populations. So I think it's probably going to be in your best interest to focus more on personal protection, the long sleeves, repellents, checking for ticks, that sort of thing.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Previous caller asked about ants, reminded me. I've got ants that are practically undermining my asphalt driveway. And they bring up, they leave their sand kernels on top of the driveway constantly. Why do they do that, and how do I stop them?
Yeah, so based on the description, I suspect what you're dealing with is a really common species of ant in the state, simply called the pavement ant. And they're given that name because they really love to hang out around sidewalks, driveways, other areas where you have concrete. And just as the caller described, they often pop up through little cracks. You'll see this kind of volcano mound of sand-like material. So that's a classic pattern for those. A few thoughts on things you could do. You could try using, from the hardware store, an ant-type product, which is a liquid formulation. You mix that up as essentially a dilute liquid, and you could try slowly pouring it into that crack and see if you can get it to soak in. Now, without seeing the crack myself, it's really hard to know if that will be able to soak in or not. If you try it and it just doesn't seem to soak in, then this approach wouldn't work. But if the crack is big enough that you can pour that material and get it to soak in and keep doing that, that should be able to help with those particular pavement ants. If not, a few other things that you could try. There are some general surface sprays you could spray in that area. It's probably not going to take them out entirely, but it may decrease and suppress their activity quite a bit. You could also try some outdoor bait stations for these ants. And we just talked about ant baits a moment ago. You'd have to find a type of bait that they like. If it is pavement ants, they tend to like formulations that are more of a protein or fat-based product, so kind of peanut butter-based, if you will. But sometimes you can find those at the hardware store, kind of an outdoor ant bait station. And if you could get that in the area and get them going to it, that may be a way to address those ant mounds and activity as well.
Carla from Fox Lake, Illinois, called, couldn't stay with us. Her cat got into some ant bait and ended up in the ER. She wants to warn people about making sure the bait you use is pet friendly.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, whenever you're using ant baits or really any pesticide, you really need to do your due diligence and read through that full label, all that fine print and all those instructions. It's on the container for a reason. In some cases, there may be very specific instructions for pets or kids or something like that. A general recommendation with baits, there are some that are in maybe bait stations that are a little bit kind of more tamper-proof, if you will. Although if you have a cat or a dog that just happens to try and eat one of these, that's a different situation. In a case like that, you could consider putting the bait stations in locations where it's going to be much harder for that animal to get to. I've even heard of some ideas along the lines of maybe taking a Tupperware or a cardboard box that you can put over the bait station itself and cut a little access door so ants can get in. But if you can weight that down or tape it down, that the animals might not be able to get to it. So that's some information as well. If you are ever in a situation, though, where a pet happens to get into one of those bait stations, make sure you save the container for it and then call like a poison control hotline for pets or your local veterinary clinic for advice. Depending on what's in there and how much the animal has gotten, that's going to kind of influence what advice or guidance that they'll provide to you.
Leisha in Spring Green, we go to you. Hi, Leisha.
Hi. In the middle of the winter, we had a kind of a warming up spell. And we got a new septic system this year, and we all of a sudden had an invasion of huge black ants in the bathroom. And they were getting in the toilet. There were like 30 of them at a time.
Hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, when I hear of large black ants indoors, that always makes me suspicious that they may be carpenter ants. In this case, has the ant activity gone away or is it still ongoing?
But it went on for quite a while.
But it's not now.
Not now, no.
Okay.
I mean, as I mentioned, it'd make me suspicious of carpenter ants. What I would probably do if the activity has truly died down, I would keep a close eye on things, especially in that general part of your house. If you had carpenter ants active during kind of cooler parts of the year, it makes me a little suspicious. There might have been something going on in the structure, in a wall or soffit area, something like that. They may be coming out to potentially look for water as simply a water source, as a resource for them. So I'd really recommend at this point kind of keeping an eye on that particular situation.
There you go, Leisha. Thank you so much for calling. PJ Leisch, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we talk insects with PJ Leisch, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, PJ, I've got to admit that yesterday I took a look at my lawn. I had not been mowing it, and the dandelions were no longer in flower, but the Creeping Charlie and the clover was. But I couldn't. I'm leaving. I'll be gone for almost 2 weeks. So I raised my mower height up 4 inches and mowed the lawn. I managed to keep a lot of Creeping Charlie and the clover, but got the lawn trimmed. Let's put it that way. Does letting your lawn grow in order to help pollinators really work?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, Larry. And it's one that I have been getting lots of questions about recently and in the last year or two, simply because of this movement referred to as no-mow May. And the general idea behind that is you don't mow for the month of May or maybe really cut back on mowing. Now, does that actually help? It really depends on the situation. And what I would say is you'd really have to look at like what's in your lawn. What are the plant species? So in your yard where you have some dandelions and clover and things like that, there may be some benefits to pollinators. But if your yard was simply a pure stand of nothing but turf grass, Kentucky bluegrass or some other sort of turf grass, and you only had grass present, then the mowing height really doesn't make a difference in a case like that. What really makes a difference for pollinators is the presence of flowering weeds more so than that mowing height. And if, again, you don't have dandelions or clover or anything like that, the mowing height really doesn't matter in a case like that. So having these flowering plants, that is what seems to make the biggest difference. Now, I'm not here to tell folks what their lawn should or shouldn't look like. Everyone is going to have an idea of their mind of what they want their yard to look like, and that's, you know, perfectly fine. If you have a lawn that has some dandelions and clover and other things like that, there can be benefits to pollinators. There is a study that came out about 8-9 years ago by Dr. Jonathan Larson at University of Kentucky and some of his colleagues, and they looked specifically at dandelions and clover, and they observed it, and they found over 50 or so different pollinator species just going to those two flowering plants in residential lawns. So again, those things can provide nectar and pollen and resources to bees and other pollinators. So one general recommendation is, if you are really interested in helping out pollinators, it's certainly not going to hurt by doing no-mow May, although if you let your lawn get too high, that can cause some problems. I know when you have our colleague Doug Soldat on, one of our turf grass specialists here at UW, he will perhaps mention something called the one-third rule. And that basically says, ideally, you don't want to take off more than a third of your lawn height at any given mowing. So if you let your lawn go all month long and it's 10 inches tall and you hack it down to 3 inches, that's going to be pretty stressful on the lawn itself because he took off a really high proportion of that. So if you are in a spot that's getting a lot of rain and your lawn is just going gangbusters this spring, one thing you could do is mowing less frequently and setting that mower height, just like you did, Larry, setting it high. If you have that grass which is 3 or more inches high, you often don't need to mow as frequently because you can let it get a little bit shaggier and you can still take off a third of it and cut it down. Versus if you're keeping your lawn really low, say 1.5 inches or 2 inches, then it doesn't have to grow very high before you're cutting off a third or more of it. So if you let your lawn go a little bit shaggier, you might have to mow less frequently. You can also encourage deeper roots on the turf grass and other plants if you do that. And also, if you're mowing less frequently, that's maybe more free time for you, maybe saving some money in the long run. Also, along these lines, if you are really serious about helping pollinators, there are some specific things called bee lawns. And University of Minnesota has done a lot of work on this, where you deliberately introduce specific flowering plants to your lawn. And these would be plants that are chosen because they are pretty well adapted for that mowed environment. They can withstand being, you know, cut down and mowed repeatedly, yet still producing flowers to provide resources for bees and other pollinators. And then one final thing, if you want your, you know, perfectly, you know, contiguous turf grass lawn, but you still want to help pollinators, you could consider putting in other plants in your yard, trees, shrubs, other flowering plants as well, outside of turf grass areas. That can be some resources in addition to basically minimizing or eliminating pesticide use in your yard. That'd be another important thing to do. But it's not the mowing so much. It's the presence of those flowering plants that is really going to help out bees and other pollinators.
And you wrote an article on the subject. I think Clara's probably has it up on our Facebook, on our page today, ideas@wpr.org/Larry. If she doesn't, she soon will. And other ways you could get at that article as well, about the plants and the ones that really work well for pollinators.
Yes, exactly.
So ideas@wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date and you'll get that article that PJ Leash wrote about those plants that do attract pollinators. I should also mention that the morning show tomorrow at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, a UW Stevens Point forestry professor joins the program to talk about challenges facing some pollinators. Particularly, I think they're zeroing in on bees tomorrow morning. That's at 7 on the Ideas Network. So another place to learn some more about it. And I'm sure they'll talk other pollinators, but I know they're zeroing in on bees. Let's go to Mary in Neillsville next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. We know we have a colony of carpenter ants on the edge of our home, and my husband feels that they can't affect the wood between the, on top of the cement foundation, because we put that blow-in closed cell insulation there. Is that right, or can they get between that foam insulation and the wood to get to the wood?
Yeah, really interesting question. When it comes to carpenter ants, one kind of common myth out there is that they eat wood, and they really don't. They don't get nutrition from wood. What they're looking for is rotting or decaying wood because it has a kind of softer texture and consistency. They can then excavate that to create space for their nest. However, similar materials that have a similar density and texture, they sometimes can tunnel into that and nest in it as well. So I've actually had cases where there wasn't any decaying wood present, but carpenter ants have nested in foam type insulation that could be insulation board or blown in polyurethane, things like that. So it's possible because of the texture of those materials, they may be able to chew through it and excavate it. So something to definitely keep an eye on this situation.
Mary, thanks for calling. You can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us the email address ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Karen in Bailey's Harbor emailed. She's wondering if there's any update regarding spotted lanternfly. Any sightings reported in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I'm really glad, Larry, that this topic came up. With spotted lanternfly, we have not had any live specimens detected here in the state. However, it's something that myself and many of my colleagues, we are watching really, really closely. If listeners have not heard of spotted lanternfly before, it's another invasive insect. It got introduced a number of years ago to parts of Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania, near New Jersey, and it's been spreading westward ever since. And just in the last couple of years, we've now had some detections in Ohio, a couple spots, Indiana, and also the lower peninsula of Michigan. So it's definitely making its way toward us here in Wisconsin. Again, we have not had any live specimens found. However, this is an insect that is a good hitchhiker. We have had at least three reports that I have heard of where dead adults had been found. These were associated either with plants that were planted in the landscape, came through a nursery production system from other U.S. states, or I have seen a case or two where these things were shipped accidentally in the mail associated with pallets and other goods like that. So they're good hitchhikers. Just like spongy moth, they have these egg masses that can be on non-plant material. So if you've got an egg mass on the underside of a vehicle or a pallet, and those items or materials are moved to Wisconsin, that could be a route of introduction. So nothing here that we've found yet, but it's probably only a matter of time before spotted lanternfly shows up in Wisconsin. So we're really trying to get the word out about that particular insect.
And what do they look like?
They really kind of stand out to me, Larry. There's not really anything else that looks quite like it. The adult spotted lanternflies are about an inch long. They somewhat resemble cicadas, but they've got these opaque grayish and blackish wings that fold back along their body. And on the wings, there's a series of basically dots and polka dots and dashes and stuff like that. So I tell folks kind of like a Morse code pattern, if you will. But if you were to open up their wings, their hind wings are a very, very vibrant neon pink with some black spots. And then their abdomen, there's a little bit of yellow there too. But very, very distinctive as adults. The juveniles might resemble juvenile stink bugs, but the first three juvenile stages or first three instars are black with white polka dots. And then as they reach maturity, kind of the adolescent stage, the fourth instar juvenile, they're black and red with some white spots on the body. So very, very distinctive. If you want to find some pictures, hop online, just search for spotted lanternfly. Look at those. Again, really easy to identify compared to other things. So it would be good for everyone to familiarize yourself with what those look like.
Let's go to John in Barnes, Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I had a quick question about what I believe is oakworm. Infested some of my trees in my yard and completely defoliated them. I didn't add it up right away when it happened, but I had a bunch of moths around in midday, thousands of them. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, I noticed my trees were losing their leaves. And pretty gushy kind of a caterpillar too. So any ideas?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was spongy moth that you're dealing with. And I just had to look up where Barnes was because I know I had heard of it, but I want to know exactly where it was on the map. And looking at where you are in northern Wisconsin, that's an area where there was a lot of spongy moth activity last year, including some very, very significant defoliation out there. The key clue you mentioned to me, not only defoliation on the oaks, and oaks is one of the favorite host plants for spongy moth caterpillars to feed on, but also the adult males have this very unusual activity of flying during the daytime. Almost all our other moths are flying after dark, but those, the males fly typically like mid-afternoon, late afternoon, but they're not as active during the evening time. So given your location, that sounds like spongy moth.
And we can talk some more about what John might be able to do at this point, if anything, with the spongy moth. And, of course, we'll take your insect questions as well with our guest, P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with PJ. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking about the world of insects today with P.J. Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you tuned in today on the show. Questions? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. PJ, back to John in Barnes, Wisconsin, which I know pretty well because we have a cabin in Barnes, the township of Barnes. But the spongy moths, and I'm sure you're correct there. Anything that John could do relating to that now? I think we talked about it earlier, but
yeah, I mean, given the northern location in the state, the eggs probably haven't hatched quite yet. They will be hatching very soon, though. So one thing that could be done would be to potentially look for and take egg masses out of the equation. But really, in this case, we'd have to look at what the overall property looks like. If this is, say, a large wooded area, there's really not going to be a whole lot of anything that you can do. A lot of the approaches that homeowners can do are meant for kind of minimizing defoliation to individual high-value trees. So maybe if you have 4 or 6 or 8 trees you want to focus on, but again, if you've got a wooded area with just dozens or hundreds of trees, there's nothing that you can really do. Your hands are kind of tied. I know the DNR does have some information on like what folks with woodlots can do for that. In some areas, there is a little bit of aerial spraying being done to help kind of slow the overall spread of spongy moth across the U.S. But it would really depend, Larry, on the context in the situation. If it's a few trees, the UW Extension spongy moth website has some great information on essentially a month-by-month basis what you can do. But if it's a woodlot situation, you'd really need to track down some resources for that. And there's probably not going to be a whole lot that you can do. On the other hand, some good news is even if trees get completely defoliated, if they were in good health to begin with, they're probably going to be okay in the long run. I do get more concerned, though, if you have trees that keep getting defoliated year after year. Then they start to really kind of run ragged and some secondary issues may pop up.
Let's take a call from Cheryl in Clark County. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Yeah, we were walking in the woods on Sunday, and I saw two small light blue-colored butterflies flying around, and I'm wondering what that would be this time of the year. I didn't think that Carner blues were in the woods, although the woods has got some open areas that were logged off a few years ago. What do you think it was?
Yeah, so when people see small bluish butterflies, they often think of Karner blues, or at least that's a common one that people have heard of. But when you look at that group, there's actually a, you know, look at all our Wisconsin butterflies, there's a group, a subfamily, which we commonly call the blues, because they all tend to be pretty small. And when their wings are open, the wings are on the top surface a bluish color. So we actually have close to a dozen or so species in that group that we can bump into in the state. You're right, though, if you're in the woods, probably not going to be a Karner blue, probably one of the other species out there. And without me seeing a good detailed photograph of it, I can't really tell you which one. Although we do have some that can pop out really pretty early in the year. There's a common one called the spring azure butterfly, which can be a common one, but there's some other ones as well. So we'd really have to see some detailed photographs, but something from that group, which, as I said, we just commonly call the blues.
Cheryl, thank you so much. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Speaking of photos, though, Mary sent us a photo of a moth who joined her while she was gardening, and she took a photo of it. She says the wings flash orange when flying. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about an ID for it.
Yeah, so that note about orange is really helpful in this case. And when I looked at the photograph that that individual had sent in, I could tell right off the bat from the shape and appearance, it's a member of our inchworm family, the Geometer moths family, Geometridae. And I was really wondering if it was this species called the orange wing. What I couldn't tell from the photo that was sent in, though, I couldn't see any evidence of the orange hind wings because the fore wings were covering them up. But just hearing that, there is a common species called the orange wing, which is kind of grayish or light brownish. The fore wings, and when those are closed over the body at rest, they just have this somewhat triangular shape. When they open the hind wings, those are in orange color. So it's a species called the orange wing.
Pam emailed us a picture. She took this photo in 2020, July of 2020. It's a beautiful insect, black body with a bright white head and a very black, I don't know, spot of some sort on that white portion of the head. What, can you identify that one?
Yeah, so this is one I recognize right off the bat. It's a very common type of beetle, close to an inch long. It's called the American carrion beetle because they like to go to carrion, basically dead stuff, stuff that maybe smells pretty bad, remains of animals, animal waste, stuff like that. That's what they go to. They're adapted to that. They use that as a food source. They'll lay eggs there. Their young will feed on those materials as well. So now, if you're ever somewhere and you see one of these very distinctive beetles with black and kind of a yellowish or pale region behind the head, that would tell me that there's probably something dead or kind of smelly nearby that they're probably looking for at the moment.
And one other picture, I don't know if you can identify this one. JW emailed it. It's not a Wisconsin spider. On their first night in Costa Rica, their son and his girlfriend were greeted by this spider. And the photo is the post-mortem photo. So I don't know if you're going to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, I took a peek at that photo, Larry, and unfortunately, I really can't tell too much from the photo. There's some size reference because there's tiles on the floor, but the spider has been dealt with and its legs are curled up. I do wonder a little bit. It looks like it may be pretty good size. There is a larger spider, pretty common in some of the tropical, subtropical areas called Heteropoda venatoria. What I can't see in the particular photo is on that spider species, it almost looks like it has a white mustache. It's got this kind of white band that goes across the front of the kind of the head region. And I can't pick that out in the photo. So what I'd really need to do in a case like this is be able to examine the specimen and do things like count and look at the arrangement and number of the eyes, because those are usually some of the very definitive traits for identifying spider families. So unfortunately, in this case, I can't really tell much from the photo, Larry.
We've talked a lot about Lyme, and this may be worth repeating. Matthew emailed us about ticks. He works as a forester, has had Lyme disease twice, and he recommends highly buying an insect shield clothing line. They are pre-treated to repel ticks. They've cut down on the number of ticks on him by about 90%.
Yeah, so that is a really good suggestion. And if you're not familiar with these clothing items, what they are, it's clothing that basically has a repellent type product impregnated into the fibers. And this is some technology that was developed a while back in cooperation with the U.S. military, because if you have soldiers deployed and serving our country overseas, depending on where they are globally, there may be disease threats from mosquitoes or other insects out there. And rather than having to always lug a bunch of repellent with you, what if your clothing did the job for you? So you can buy this kind of insect or bug shield clothing where it's already in there. It will last through many washes. I don't have any of these myself, but I've browsed some of the information about them, and they may last upwards of 50 or so washings in some cases. But you might have to pay a little bit more up front. Another option, if you already have some outdoor clothing that you're really fond of, you can buy clothing treatments that contain permethrin. And this is a repellent type product. Rather than wearing the clothing and spraying it on, what you'd do is you'd lie out your clothes, you'd spray this on there, and it's long-lasting residual protection that will repel ticks. But also, if they contact it long enough, it will help kill them outright. So those are some types of products that I know my colleagues that do a lot of tick research, they tend to use those things like the permethrin type treatments or the clothing impregnated with the repellent. Tends to work very, very well.
Jim in Greenfield wonders, he has a colony of bees building a nest under his deck. There's a pile of sawdust under their colony. Could they be eating his deck? He doesn't know what to do with them because they're pollinators. But they also need to be moved and wonders what should he do.
Yeah, so this is really an interesting one, Larry. I think what might be going on is these may be carpenter bees. Carpenter bees are pretty good size. They're often mistaken for bumblebees because of their large size. Their coloration is very similar to many bumblebees. But bumblebees, we know, like to nest in the ground, typically in old rodent burrows and similar locations. But these carpenter bees will go to softer wood. So maybe if you have like a cedar deck or a cedar fence or something along those lines, they will actually tunnel in. They go in maybe an inch or so, they make a 90 degree turn, and they start tunneling in other directions. That's how they construct their nests. They provision it with pollen and nectar resources for their young. They wall it off, and they maybe produce 10 or 12 little cells in there. And those new bees will emerge next year. If this is an issue, a few things could be done. If there's a way to physically block off access to where the bees are getting to, that might help. In general, if you have wood that is painted or sealed, something to really kind of coat over the surface, that often does enough to help deter them. Versus if it's something like cedar and it's unstained, unpainted, that may be more attractive to them. So that could be an option, is if you can access it, painting it over. There are technically some insecticides that could be used, but again, the caller recognized these are beneficial pollinators. So if you have to treat that nest, you will be taking out those pollinators. There are also some other options out there. If you go online, there are some traps available for these carpenter bees, where it uses a little container and a wood source, and they may go to it, get trapped in there, and then you could release them elsewhere. That's something that you could look into and potentially try as well.
Let's take a call from Rosie in Ashland next. Hi, Rosie.
Good morning. My sister-in-law in Denver told me today that we're back having millers in Denver, which is some kind of moth, I believe, because of the way their wings fold. But they seem to collect under the hood of your car if you leave it parked long enough, and then as you're going down the highway, they fan out behind you.
Millers.
Yeah, so this is a moth that I have heard of. It's technically not native, but it's from parts of Europe, but it does show up in some of the western states, places like Colorado, Wyoming. I don't think I've ever necessarily bumped into it here, but I have heard reports from areas like Colorado before.
Thank you, Rosie, for calling. Andy in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We own an old farmhouse that was built around 1903, and it's not very well sealed up. We have a problem in the spring and in the fall with flies and then eventually Asian beetles. It seems like they're trying to come in the fall and get out in the spring.
Yeah.
Is there a way of controlling that? I've tried different things, and nothing seems to really help that much.
Sure. Well, we talked a little bit about this earlier. We had a caller ask about stink bugs in their house and what to do about that. And the overall management is the same for some of the flies that will get in, like cluster flies are a common thing that sneaks in late summer, early fall. And also those multicolored Asian lady beetles, those will, of course, sneak into homes as well. So when you look at the big picture and the grand scheme of things, for the long term, one of the best things you can do is physical exclusion. So looking at potential entry points, cracks, crevices, edges of siding, especially around door and window frames, edges of soffit areas, base of the siding at the where the siding meets the foundation, spots like that, if we can physically seal those areas up with better weather stripping, caulk, backer rods, expanding insulation foam, that can help seal things up. If they can't get in, then they won't be a problem during the winter months. However, if you have a home where you look and it's just not feasible to seal everything up, I would still seal up what you can as best as possible. There are some insecticide treatments that can be applied to the exterior of your home in those same spots, so around window and door frames, edges. The idea being that we can try and repel or kill them before they get indoors in the fall. And if we keep them out in the fall, then you won't have problems during the winter or spring months. So those are some general suggestions on what you could do.
Andy, thank you so much. Let's go to Kathy in Madison next. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi. I've had the plants for 22 years. But last year, what I thought was a small plastic bag was in the pines, and I went to pull it out. It was actually a bunch of miniature bumblebees, and they were extremely aggressive. I mean, I got bit like 8 times. I had to jump in my little Walmart pool to get away from them. And that's the first time I've ever seen them. My neighbor said they were bullhead bees, but I don't know if he's right. So is that something new, and can I look forward to seeing them again?
Yeah, really interesting description of the scenario. I mean, when it comes to bumblebees, we actually have somewhere in the ballpark about 20 or more different species that have been documented in the state. And some of our bumblebees can be really quite large and noticeable, you know, an inch or so in length. However, I will say we have quite a few bumblebee species that can be relatively small, under half an inch or less in size. And so just based on the description, if you bumped into a colony of insects, it really makes me wonder if you might have encountered one of these smaller bumblebee species.
Or wasps?
That could be a possibility as well. I mean, if it generally looked like a bumblebee, though, it would suggest to me maybe a bumblebee species. There are some colonial wasps out there, but usually those are much more recognizable because of the more conspicuous black and yellow stripes on the body.
And they're not likely, they're not going to come back to the same spot.
Usually, no. There could be evolutionary reasons for that. If you went back to last year's nest site, well, what if last year's nest had died out because of a disease or something? You wouldn't necessarily want to do that. However, if there is still a good hollow spot that could be a nesting site that's big enough, they sometimes can go back to the same or similar location. So a general recommendation I have this time of the year, or maybe even earlier in the spring, is before bumblebees are starting to look for nesting spots or other social wasps, things like that, look for potential nesting sites, seal things up as best as you can. So if you know there's rodent burrows around, fill those in. If there is a hole in a stone foundation or something like that, filling that in will help prevent insects from setting up shop in those locations.
Stacy in Monona wonders, she has ants under her asphalt and sidewalk, and we talked about that earlier, but she's wondering if she can use bleach on them.
Yeah, in general, I wouldn't recommend that. There's all sorts of home remedies that you can see out there from bleach and vinegar and things like that, and I just haven't seen the science backing that up. So I would recommend more of some of the more conventional approaches.
Jennifer in Duluth wonders about the big families of earwigs at the top of her common milkweed. She doesn't like their pincers. In order to help the monarch, she bought a bug vacuum to take the predator out of play on her milkweed. Are earwigs good for anything? Should she save them or kill them after she vacuums them?
Yeah, that's an interesting case, Lear. I mean, in general, it's hard to find many fans of earwigs. I think part of it is their appearance. They've got this just general body appearance that looks like they could really pinch you pretty hard, but they can't. Those are mostly for show, or they use them for mating purposes for some earwig species. In general, they can do some good things in the ecosystem and in the environment. Earwigs tend to be omnivores, so they can act as predators at times. I've done some experiments years ago surveying insects at night and occasionally seeing earwigs feeding on caterpillars and things like that. They can also, if they are crawling around on flowers, might be doing a little bit of pollination, actually. Probably not a whole lot compared to something like a bee, but they might be doing a little bit of pollination when they go about crawling in flowers in those nooks and crannies. So they can do some good. You wouldn't necessarily have to kill them, but you could, if you're concerned and trying to maximize reproduction of monarch caterpillars, you could remove them from those plants and chuck them elsewhere, release them somewhere else in your yard if you want.
Robin emailed, she has an abundance of what seems to be metallic green sweat bees this spring. She's wondering if they're especially numerous this year for some reason, or if something else might be causing her to just happen to see more. Also, she's seen a few different sizes of what she assumes are the metallic green sweat bees. Different varieties, or just male versus female, or something else?
It's probably different species that the caller is bumping into. When you think about sweat bees, family Halictidae, we have a bunch of different species out there, and they do vary in appearance. Often they are a metallic green color, but they can vary a bit in size. They sometimes have green with some yellow or black and yellow or black and white stripes on the body. It is pretty cool that the caller noticed a bunch of different maybe species and activity in their yard, because those are native beneficial pollinators out there. So sometimes they nest in the ground, sometimes they go to insect holes and rotting logs and stuff like that. But it's actually a good thing to have those out in your yard.
PJ, on that note, we are about out of time. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me today, Larry.
PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. It's always a pleasure to have him come by, and certainly he will be back, and we'll do this all over again with him. Let's look ahead to tomorrow for the Larry Mueller Show. We venture into the world of old-fashioned and fish fries with the novel Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club. I finished reading it about a week ago. It's a dandy book. A lot about supper clubs, but also good relationships or interesting relationships between mothers and daughters and grandmothers. So that comes into play for sure. So I'm looking forward to that. And then our second author will be on to talk about, in this world full of gender-based stereotypes, one author and parent tells us how to raise boys into well-rounded human beings. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.